The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt in the West Coast studio of the Salem News Channel, and I will be spending the first 2 hours today reviewing last night's 68-minute State of the Union address by President Biden. There are literally thousands of assessments and takes out there. You can pick and choose, but I thought it would be interesting for an American audience especially to get a reaction from Israel of the 8 minutes, 5 minutes, and 13 seconds were devoted to 10-7 and its aftermath, the war in Gaza, the massacre of the Israelis, the taking of hostages, including somewhere between 5 and 8 Americans. I'm never quite sure. So I asked Haviv Rettig-Gur to join me. Haviv is the senior analyst for the Times of Israel. You see him or hear him frequently on Dan Senor's Call Me Back podcast. Been a guest a few times of mine. He has also now started a new podcast at the Times of Israel called What Matters Now, which is must listening. Haviv, good afternoon to you, and thank you for joining me for an hour here to talk about this. I appreciate on such short notice. Let's begin with your general reaction to what President Biden had to say last night about Israel and the war in Gaza.
I have to make a very clear point here. There are things I wish he'd said that he didn't. There are things he said I wish he'd said differently. But the primary response to President Biden that I think is incumbent on Israelis, first of all, is gratitude. And I have to say that, and it's important to say that, this president has done in the moment when we needed the door to remain open, the missile shipments to continue, the actual military help, he has continued that. I say that as a precursor to complaining about all the things that I think weren't, I think, wise in terms of his policy going forward. But the first thing that an Israeli owes this White House and many White Houses in the past, but the first thing that an Israeli owes is gratitude. And I want to say that he recognized the hostage families in the speech. There was a standing ovation in Congress. I don't think every single member of Congress enjoyed that standing ovation. It did represent the large majority. He did say that, you know, we have a right to go after Hamas. He did hold that door open. These are not small things. You can imagine within the Democratic Party, there are forces demanding from him to change his tune on those things, and he hasn't. And for that, first of all, gratitude.
Haviv, I think that's very generous, and we'll go through that. I'm also not surprised. John Podhoretz has continually made the point that the president is trying to have it both ways, but that facts always intrude, and the fact is the weapon deliveries especially have continued. I would like to take the 5 minutes and 13 seconds necessary for our listeners who did not hear that segment of the speech or did not hear all of it to hear that before we go through it with Haviv. So let's play that now. This is the president last night talking specifically about Israel, the hostages, aid, and Gaza. Cut number one.
You know, as we manage challenges at home, we're also managing crises abroad, including in the Middle East. I know the last 5 months have been gut-wrenching for so many people. For the Israeli people, for the Palestinian people, and so many here in America. This crisis began on October 7th with the massacre by a terrorist group called Hamas, as you all know. 1,200 innocent people, women and girls, men and boys, slaughtered after enduring sexual violence. The deadliest day for the Jewish people since the Holocaust, and 250 hostages taken. Here in this chamber tonight are families whose loved ones are still being held by Hamas. I pledge to all the families that we will not rest until we bring every one of your loved ones home. We will also work around the clock to bring home Evan and Paul, Americans being unjustly detained by the Russians and others around the world. Israel has a right to go after Hamas. Hamas ended this conflict by releasing hostages, laying down arms, could end it by releasing the hostages, laying down arms, and surrendering those responsible for October 7th. But Israel has a added burden because Hamas hides and operates among the civilian population like cowards under hospitals, daycare centers, and all the like. Israel also has a fundamental responsibility, though, to protect innocent civilians in Gaza. This war has taken a greater toll on innocent civilians than all previous wars in Gaza combined. More than 30,000 Palestinians have been killed, most of whom are not Hamas. Thousands and thousands of innocents, women and children, girls and boys, also orphaned. Nearly 2 million more Palestinians under bombardment or displacement. Homes destroyed, neighbors in rubble, cities in ruin. Families without food, water, medicine. It's heartbreaking. I've been working nonstop to establish an immediate ceasefire that would last for 6 weeks to get all the prisoners released, all the hostages released, to get the hostages home and ease the intolerable and humanitarian crisis and build toward something more enduring. The United States has been leading international efforts to get more humanitarian assistance to Gaza. Tonight, I'm directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the coast of Gaza that can receive large shipments carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters. No U.S. boots will be on the ground. A temporary pier will enable a massive increase in the amount of humanitarian assistance getting into Gaza every day. And Israel must do its part. Israel must allow more aid into Gaza to ensure humanitarian workers aren't caught in the crossfire. And they're announcing they're going to have a crossing in northern Gaza. For the leadership of Israel, I say this. Humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority. As we look to the future, the only real solution to the situation is a two-state solution over time. And I say this as a lifelong supporter of Israel. My entire career, no one has a stronger record with Israel than I do. I challenge any of you here. I'm the only American president to visit Israel in wartime. But there is no other path that guarantees Israel's security and democracy. There is no other path that guarantees that Palestinians can live in peace with peace and dignity. And there's no other path that guarantees peace between Israel and all of its neighbors, including Saudi Arabia, with whom I'm talking. Creating stability in the Middle East also means containing the threat posed by Iran. That's why I built a coalition of more than a dozen countries to defend international shipping and freedom of navigation in the Red Sea. I've ordered strikes to degrade the Houthi capability and defend U.S. forces in the region. As Commander-in-Chief, I will not hesitate to direct further measures to protect our people and our military personnel.
That was the conclusion of that portion. Habib, before our first break, we go up and down on the radio side here and we continue to talk. President's number of 30,000 innocent Gazans, the most of whom are not Hamas. Your reaction to that number?
The Israelis believe they killed 13,000 Hamas fighters. Hamas was actually forced out of the sheer ridiculousness of its claim for 4 long months that it had zero dead over the course of 4 months of fighting. And all the dead in Gaza were civilians, had to admit 6,000. I suspect the Israeli number is much closer to the truth. And 30,000 might not be, it might be lower than that because there is no fact checking on the ground in Gaza. There is only Hamas. And so I wish the president had, you know, on other things, he was very careful. He said things like most of the dead in Gaza are civilians. That's true according to Israel. That's true according to everybody. It's 1.3 to 1, maybe 1.5 to 1. That's better than the war against ISIS. But nevertheless, don't use those 30,000 number. that's my, you know, offhand comment. We need to say something he could have said. I don't know. I wish there was more clarity, and I wish there was less trust of Hamas on the ground.
I will be right back with Haviv Redinger after our first break. We've got all hour, and during the break, I'll be talking with Haviv. I want to strongly recommend to you that you add to your bookmark link Times of Israel, and you follow his brand new What Matters Now podcast with Amanda Dan from the Times of Israel, as well as the Times of Israel daily update that comes down. I also recommend to you Dan Senor's Call Me Back pod, the podcast by Daniil Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi, which I'll get to a little bit later about. It just confuses the heck out of me. And commentary podcast. If you are at all concerned with being well informed about this, you can't rely on American media. It just doesn't cover it in depth. You've got to get Israeli media. And Haviv Redinger is one of the people that you want to turn to. I'll talk to him during the break. We'll be right back after the break. Stay tuned, America. I am back now with Haviv Redinger from Israel during our break from the radio. Haviv, I wanted to also ask you about Israel's, quote, fundamental responsibility to not use humanitarian aid as a bargaining chip. I have not seen any evidence that Israel has used humanitarian aid as a bargaining chip. Have you?
No, we haven't seen that evidence. I have been critical of the Israeli government. I do wish that it would understand faster that the war against Hamas went much better, much faster than it expected in military terms. And we're now in many parts of Gaza in the day after, where we have to start thinking about who runs the place after us, where, how the humanitarian aid gets in, how you begin to bring an Arab world, a Saudi-led, an Emirati-led force in that can deliver humanitarian aid. So in that sense, substantively, I think that the president maybe shares my own criticism that Israel has to move faster because the war went better than it expected. It expected to have a year to fight Hamas and then worry about all of the building out humanitarian, building out, rebuilding Gaza, you know, building out the day after. But to frame it that way, look, I'll put it this way. Some Israeli politicians in their bombastic posturing and bomb throwing within politics have been angry about the idea of humanitarian aid, A, because Hamas steals all of it. And on the fringes of Israeli politics, they've also said things like they don't get humanitarian aid until the hostages come out. To use that in this speech in that way is to turn these fringes as if that's what Israel actually is doing, as if that's what Israel actually believes. The humanitarian aid is flowing. The single largest obstacle to humanitarian aid is the fact that UNRWA drivers, Egyptian drivers of trucks, are threatened. The single greatest problem is that Hamas is stealing the aid at a massive scale. There are gun battles in Gaza. We have seen gun battles in Gaza between clans that are asked to help protect the aid so that Hamas doesn't protect the aid, so that Hamas doesn't steal all the aid. And we have, that has resulted in gun battles between these clans and Hamas. There's tremendous problem in Gaza. And you know why there's a problem distributing aid in Gaza? Because Hamas wants there to be a problem distributing aid in Gaza. Hamas wants the delay. It wants to drag this out. It wants hunger. It wants suffering. It's literally its entire war strategy. It built tunnels the 1.5 times the size of the London tube system underneath the cities of Gaza. It's the single largest construction project in Palestinian history. It spent 17 years ruling Gaza, building nothing else. I challenge the listeners to Google that. Find something else Hamas has built. All it did was transform Gaza into a battlefield in which civilians must be passed through to get to Hamas. It is not that it's hiding behind civilians as some kind of tactic. That is its fundamental strategic concept. And the aid is part of that concept. And so I'll put it even more sharply. It isn't that President Biden accused us of using humanitarian aid as a bargaining chip. That, you know, you want to curse us, fine. He spent so much. The missile shipments continue. The help in the war effort continues. At some point, for Democratic Party politics, he has to throw us under a bus. I truly am okay with that. By the way, I said 5 months ago, I expect that to happen at some point. I'm okay with it. He still deserves our gratitude. Here's the problem. He's about to build a pier and deliver aid. Okay, Who do you think is going to be on the other side?
Hold that thought, Habib, because we're coming back on, and I want to talk about the pier, which was the first surfaced yesterday and has awakened in me echoes of Beirut 1983, and I'm old enough to remember that. One of the more stunning announcements, and I probably watched 40 to maybe 50 of these things. We're coming right back on the radio. Stay with us. Welcome back, America. I thought it would be good for the country to get the reaction of an Israeli political analyst and senior reporter from the Times of Israel, Habib Redinger, who has sort of burst upon the scene in America as a very perceptive student of American politics in the context of living the war in Israel. Just back, by the way, I learned yesterday from a tour of American college campuses, including my alma mater at Harvard, G.W. Brown and others. That was one of the better pods I've ever heard of, Eve. And I didn't realize you had such a good grasp of the American political theory, as well as of Zionism. And we'll come back to this, but let's get to the Gaza Pier. Because yesterday, out of nowhere, came the announcement that the president would seek to build a pier. And this has struck many of us as an incredibly bad idea for a lot of reasons, including Beirut of 1983. Explain. We got about a 5 to 6 minute segment here. Tell us your thoughts on this latest iteration of the president's attempt to have it both ways on the war.
Yeah. President Biden said something absolutely right. And then he said a whole bunch of things that I don't think anyone really quite understands. I don't think that people quite understand the pier. He said that Israel has an added burden to protect civilians. And then he said it's a result of Hamas's cowardice and its fundamental strategy of hiding behind civilians. That's what that entire tunnel network is. It is the biggest thing ever built by Palestinians, you know, and it is all it is Hamas hiding behind civilians at a strategic scale. So what the president said is that places on Israel an added burden. You know what? Okay, I even agree with that. And then he began to, then you saw the Democrats give a standing ovation to his statement, Israel has a fundamental burden to protect innocent civilians. And then he came in with an accusation where he said, you can't hold up aid as a bargaining chip. Now, some, you know, the edges of Israeli politics, we've talked about this, have said things like that. The Israeli strategy on the ground, that is not what is holding up aid. The main thing holding up aid, blocking aid at a massive scale, is Hamas. So when and I mean literally Hamas, I mean they're Egyptian truck drivers who are warning other Egyptian truck drivers, don't take aid in, don't volunteer for these missions. You will get attacked, you will get hurt. There have been gun battles in Gaza between clans and Hamas, not with the Israelis, over control of aid, over stealing aid. And so when the president then says, we're going to build a pier with the U.S. military to be able to deliver aid at a massive scale, what does he mean? Who's going to control the aid? The U.S. had an airdrop of meals over Gaza. The problem with dropping meals over Gaza, it turns out, is you don't know who's going to pick it up on the ground. Well, who do you think is going to pick it up on the ground? The people most willing to murder anyone who won't hand it over to them. In other words, Hamas. Until Hamas is removed, the problem of getting aid to Gaza remains Hamas. Hamas's fundamental strategy is to make sure Palestinians suffer massively. That is their only plan for survival. That's why they built a tunnel network 1.5 times the size of the London Tube. That is what Hamas is. It isn't anything else. You want to build a pier? Who's standing on the other side of that pier? The problem with getting aid into Gaza is not the infrastructure of how to get it off a boat. By the way, the reason to build a pier, according to President Biden, is to sidestep the Egyptians. Well, why are you having trouble bringing aid in through Egypt? If Israel is the problem, why is there trouble bringing aid in through Egypt? And the answer is always the same, Hamas. I'll tell you another thing. President Biden reiterated very, very longstanding American policy and especially Democratic Party policy. And, you know, a policy I completely agree with. In the end, we need two states. I'm not necessarily agreeing with, you know, every person on the Israeli political right on this. We need two states in the end. Here's the problem. In his speech, if you frame Palestinian statehood as the result of October 7, you lose the Israelis who are absolutely convinced, okay, that October 7 taught us that every inch of land we give up, Hamas will use to murder our children. You want to sell the Israeli public on Palestinian statehood, which you have to do. Palestinian statehood, whether it's fair or unfair, galling or good, it doesn't matter what you think of it morally. Palestinian statehood, to work, must pass through Israeli politics. You sell it as a result of Hamas's destruction. The Israelis have been saying for decades, if they didn't keep killing us, we would be able to withdraw. The Israelis at least twice elected governments with the explicit, literally what the election was about, was establishing a Palestinian state, and that won elections in Israel. You want to get that back? You want to get the Israeli political capacity to do that back? You have to frame it as a result of Hamas destruction.
I will be back after the longer break with Aviv Rediger of the Times of Israel. Again, his brand new podcast, which is off. It can't be often enough. It's called What Matters Now. It's hosted at the Times of Israel. Go and follow it, as well as the Times of Israel Daily Briefing. Dan Senor's Call Me Back podcast as well. I'll be right back with Aviv. The two-state solution is going to pick up our long segment. During the break, we'll talk. Stay tuned. Aviv, I think it's remarkable that you are fluent in two political systems to the extent you are. A lot of people are fluent in many languages. I'm not, but not many people are fluent in two political systems. And I am not fluent in Israeli politics, although I try with Dr. Oren and others to stay abreast of the news. I have no opinions on your Supreme Court battle because I've taught con law for 25 years. And I know how hard it is to teach con law anywhere else. But in terms of the American political, you're obviously fluent in American politics. You spent a decade here. You've been on our campuses. You see what's happening to the Democratic Party. Does it alarm you? And what? And by that, I don't want to put coat on you. I believe it's going to the left dramatically, and it's being influenced by a radical element that is anti-Israel and anti-Zionist. And yesterday on your podcast, you said there are three kinds of people in America who view Israel: ignorant people, genocidal people, and Zionists. And I'm one of the Zionists. It's hard to be an Irish Catholic Zionist, but that's what I am. It's a democracy. It's our ally. What do you think is happening to the Democratic Party?
I have a lot of thoughts about that branch of the Democratic Party and about young Americans who statistically are leaning in that direction. My main thought, however, isn't that, you know, I'm nervous that they're not going to like me. I'm Israeli. I don't do nervous that they're not going to like me.
Yes.
That's not the kind of Jews we are. My main thought is it's not going to work. In other words, the left wing of the Democratic Party is very angry at President Biden right now. And the thing they're angry at him for is that he held Israel's hand. He backed Israel up. He sent aircraft carrier task forces, two of them, into the Mediterranean. He told Israel on October 8th, we're with you. Now, they said, well, that allowed the war. And that tells me that this left wing of the Democratic Party is incompetent. Not that it's against me, but that it literally will have the opposite result of what it expects if it actually gets into power. Because after October 7, the Israelis looked up at the world around them and realized that all these terrible enemies that surround them, Hezbollah, Iran, all the militias in Yemen, Yemen, Iraq, Syria, they mean it. They're not deterred. They're going to destroy their own countries to destroy us. That's the thing Hamas taught us. And so the world suddenly looked a lot more dangerous, and we were gearing up for a war to make our borders safe again. And how many wars would we fight? How many borders would we fight? How backed up against the wall do we feel? How ferocious do we need to be? That's the question happening in the Israeli political elites, in the Israeli political leadership. And Biden understood that, and he said, whoa, 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 Israelis, I got your back. I'm deterring Iran. Here's the army, the American army. Go slow. Think. Fight carefully. The war in Gaza that we have seen is how it looks when Israel fights carefully. If President Biden had done what the progressive wing of the Democratic Party wanted him to do, which was kick us under a bus and throw us to the wind, what did they think would have happened? They think we would have what? Fall down and cried? They think we would not have gone to war in Gaza? America could have bombed us to prevent a war in Gaza. We still would have gone to war in Gaza. The two options before President Biden were tell the Israelis they're safe and can go slow, or let the Israelis feel this desperate vulnerability, because all the lesson they learned with Hamas in Gaza is true on all the other fronts. They want them dead. All of the big Iranian proxies, that whole array throughout the Middle East that wants to destroy them. This could have been a big war or a little war. President Biden chose a little war. President Biden saved. He saved Palestinian lives. He saved Israeli lives. He certainly saved Lebanese lives. And the progressive wing of the Democratic Party would have not saved those lives. And so, you know, as you go further into the left of the Democratic Party, I don't think you get anti-me. Great, you can get anti-me. By the way, I talk to Republicans who once in a while, I meet a Republican who says, I don't want to support you with life aid money. And I say to them, that is not a conversation that I have a right to get into. That's your tax money. I respect that. I mean, you're getting a lot out of it. The Pentagon basically uses us as a big R&D shop.
Yes.
Truly, it does. I mean, they let us build all the things that the American internal, you know, development process can't sanction, can't, you know, sign off on because there's too much red tape. That's kind of how we are used. We're also very stable. We're also a guaranteed ally, all that stuff. But you know what? You make a different decision with your tax money. I have no choice. I'm literally morally not allowed to have a response except thank you for everything you've done. That is my only permissible response in my view. But I got to tell you, the farther left you get in the Democratic Party, my concern isn't that they start hating me. I really don't care. My concern is that they get dumb. That's my concern. We competent policy.
We'll be right back on the air with Habib to continue that. Stay tuned, America. Welcome back, America. I continue my conversation with Habib Redegur. You should listen to and follow his brand new podcast, What Matters Now, with Amanda Dan from the Times of Israel and the Times of Israel Daily Briefing. Habib, I listened last night, and when the president mentioned no one has a better record than him, I've only interviewed the president once. I've only met him once. It was, in fact, when I was broadcasting from AIPAC after I had spoken to AIPAC. And he is indeed a longtime supporter of Israel with a very solid record, like most Republicans that I know, supporting our only democratic ally in the Middle East. And it is a democracy, and it's vibrant, and it's confusing as hell, but they are good allies with whom we have disagreements sometimes about various things. And we're not very good at understanding Israeli politics. But the one thing I understand is that the two-state solution, because Mike Pompeo is a friend and Tom Cotton is a friend, the two-state solution is so far away from happening. It might arrive someday. It's not going to arrive in my lifetime. I don't think it's going to arrive in your lifetime, maybe in the lifetime of my grandchildren and your children. But let's listen to what he said again last night and then have you comment on this and educate, because my greatest distress is that he did not educate the American public about this war, the nature of Hamas, the nature of Islamist extremism. Why in the world is Sunni Islamist extremism that's Wahhabist in origins in the Muslim Brotherhood is aligned with the Shia fundamentalism, which aims to rule and dominate the region? He just blew the opportunity. But this was maybe the worst part. Cut number 7.
As we look to the future, the only real solution to the situation is a two-state solution over time. And I say this as a lifelong supporter of Israel. My entire career, no one has a stronger record with Israel than I do. I challenge any of you here. I'm the only American president to visit Israel in wartime. But there is no other path that guarantees Israel's security and democracy. There is no other path that guarantees that Palestinians can live in peace with peace and dignity. And there's no other path that guarantees peace between Israel and all of its neighbors, including Saudi Arabia, with whom I'm talking.
Okay, Habib, alchemy is the medieval attempt to turn anything into gold, and it was always false. The two-state solution may be out there, but what's your reaction to an American lecturing the world on the two-state solution, not just Israel, but the world, as being the only path forward?
I think he means it honestly. I have four little kids. My four little kids are going to grow up in a country that has two peoples in it that believe that they are two different peoples and don't want to live together. The one thing Israelis and Palestinians agree on is that we don't want all of us to be in the same state, because we each want self-determination. We each want self-reliance. We each want independence of each other, separation. That is still the majority opinion. When people say otherwise in polls, it's because they don't think it's possible. But if you ask them if anything were possible, they do still want two states. The trouble with talking about it as a moral point is that there isn't also a strategic point. they don't have in the United States, in Washington, among especially, I think, on this administration or the Democratic Party. Again, I do believe that our primary duty is gratitude. I believe it, and I'll say it again and again. But they don't have a strategic vision for how to get there. It is not enough to want it, and it is not enough to talk about process, and it is not enough to talk about how we're going to get everybody in a room. We've been doing that for 30 years, elites sitting and having peace processes and negotiated processes and processes to talk about the future processes. What we need now is to get to fundamental things. The reason we don't have two states, the reason that even though the Israelis twice in their history elected governments whose position, whose explicit policy was two states, and that's what the election was about, we still don't have. The reason every peace process ends in a Palestinian wave of terrorism, like 140 suicide bombings in the Second Intifada, the reason that we keep, or in October, in 2010, President Obama squeezed out of Israel, out of Netanyahu himself, a 10-month settlement freeze, and over those 10 months, the Palestinian leadership never even came to the table. That was the last time President Obama, desperate to be on the Palestinian side, would ever invest his own political capital in the Palestinians. The reason the Palestinians are unable, at the end of the day, to come to that table is that Hamas, and not just Hamas, parts of Fatah as well, sell them on a story that we are destroyable. We are a fake, artificial thing. That's what they mean when they talk about us as colonialism. And we can be removed. If you are a Palestinian and you think that we can be removed, and that is something your elites have been selling you really for 100 years, then it is treason to compromise. Until we talk about the Palestinian story of us, the Palestinian interpretation of us, the Palestinian belief that a little more pressure, a little more violence, a few more children murdered, a few more women murdered, a few more massacres, and all Palestine will be free of the Jews forever and ever. Until we talk about that folly, that strategic misdiagnosis, if it was true, well done. More massacres, we leave, you win. But it's not true. Let's leave morality aside and just talk about strategic truths. It is not true. We have nowhere to go. We don't know how to go. We will not disappear. Until Palestinian politics gets that deeply, fundamentally, there's nothing President Biden can do for them. He can build all the piers in the world. Hamas will steal the aid to make Palestinians suffer, to make the cost for Israel higher, because Sinwar believes, that Israel can eventually be destroyed. Israel cannot be destroyed no matter how much Palestinians suffer for it, no matter how much their political elites or the Arab world around them makes them suffer for it. If Israel cannot be destroyed, what's plan B? By the way, it can't be destroyed if America turns on Israel. Israel had already become a regional superpower when America became Israel's ally in around 1970. It had already won the 67 war and the 56 war and the 48 war. Everybody, including America. I don't think Americans are stupid. The Palestinian argument is that Americans are stupid. They like Israel because of some kind of emotional outburst, because they are manipulated by some lobbyists, because of all these idiot reasons. Americans started to appreciate Israel in a serious way, and the Pentagon started supporting an alliance with Israel when Israel was already powerful. You detach us from our American friends and allies. Maybe that's a good thing, because then maybe Palestinians see us for, again, 20 more years not collapse and start to think maybe we're being sold BS. Maybe we're being sold a bad theory of the Israelis. So that's my response to President Biden. You want two states? I want two states. The future of my family depends on it. Don't fall into process. Don't fall into sending Secretary Blinken and thinking you're doing something. We need deep reconciliation and a fundamental change of narratives right now, primarily on the Palestinian side. Or put another way, when Hamas is destroyed utterly, profoundly, and is seen to be destroyed by the Palestinians, maybe we will have a Palestinian political discussion that says, hey, maybe the Israelis aren't going anywhere. Maybe we need a plan B.
Well, that is where I thought the Trump administration and the Abraham Accords had maybe laid the foundation for moving forward, the recognition by Sunni Arab states that Israel is here, it's not going anywhere, and we, in fact, don't even want it to go anywhere. We kind of want to partner with them, led by the UAE, then joined by Bahrain and Morocco, and the Saudis are close behind, but they remain ambivalent about the so-called Arab Street. They don't want to get assassinated like Sadat. They don't want to end up dead, and they don't want to end up with the Muslim Brotherhood. Now I want to go to the real impact. I stopped. I was out trundling yesterday listening to you, and you commented that when my alma mater hosted you and the Harvard demonstrations arose, you were amused by the theater, as I am often amused by the theater, but the impact on the American Jewish kids. I met my first Jews at Harvard, right? I lived with Jews for 4 years at Harvard. I didn't know anything about Israel other than what I had read, but I didn't know any Jews because I grew up Irish Catholic in Ohio, and I learned Harvard was a very welcoming place and no one was threatened by anyone. I was stunned to hear that the impact on the Jewish students at Harvard is fear. I was also inspired to hear your assessment that they're creating Zionists all over the world. Would you expand on that for the audience? People need to listen to that whole podcast that I pushed out hard yesterday because it's profound in many respects. What is the fallout on young American Jewry of all of this?
Yeah, I was on the Harvard Law campus. I was giving a talk. A bunch of students came. The hall was, the speaking room, I don't know what they call them, lecture hall was pretty full. And off on the side, there was a group of protesters who got up and tried to disrupt the event and walked right through the middle of it. And I was really excited because I'm an Israeli and I would now have a picture of me facing protesters on college campuses I could take back to Israel for some street cred. And I jokingly said, everybody, we're going to take a pause for, theatrical intermission. And the protesting kids were very, very upset with me. And we had a little bit of a back and forth that, again, I thought I won by being very, very clever and witty and was really enjoying myself. Not because I don't think that Palestinians need sympathy around the world, but because I don't think these kids have any idea what's going on. And and somebody for some reason, when I went to college at Hebrew University in Israel, in Jerusalem, I was told on day one, you don't know much, so pipe down and learn. And someday when you've learned something, we'd love to hear your opinion. And for some reason, these kids arrive at college campuses having been trained to think by TikTok and are told by the universities of America, by the most elite universities of America, you know so much that we are going to rely on you to make the great moral judgments of what happens on this campus, which is weird to me. But nevertheless, these kids are walking out and I'm enjoying myself very much. And then I turn to look at the audience, which is primarily Jewish students. And I stopped enjoying myself. Because I realized, I kind of had known this, but I didn't see it until that moment, until last week on the Harvard campus. I realized that they were not enjoying themselves. They did not think this was funny. And they did not, look at the intellectual unseriousness of these protesters and just laugh to themselves because they're not getting on a plane back to Israel. They saw this as an attack on them. And I thought to myself, wait a second. These protesters don't speak Hebrew. Israelis aren't seeing them. They don't think Israelis are seeing them. They don't care if Israelis see them because Israelis aren't the target. Israelis aren't the audience. Who is the audience? And it dawns on me that the audience are the Jewish kids on campus. They're the closest target they can reach. So they are targeting those Jewish kids. And then I got really angry. And then the protesters managed to really make me upset. So well done.
I got to stress to people,
we have studies of this.
They have to go and listen to this conversation with Amanda Dan and Habib yesterday. It's eye-opening. It's also wrenching about what's happened on American campuses. And it will bring home the immediacy of the problem of the Hamas massacre and 10-7 in America that goes beyond our own American hostages. I'll be right back with Habib. Stay tuned. I'm back with Habib Redegur. Habib, we've got three more rather short segments, 5, 7, and 5 minutes, and I want to cover a couple of things with you. First of all, I listened last night to Daniel Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi talking about the aid convoy that was ambushed. And I don't understand what happened there, but neither do they, and nobody does. What is internal to Israel, the division that is developing now, and where do those two guys fit on the map? I know American politics backwards and forwards. I've been doing this for a long time, but I have no idea where people fit in the constellation, and I sometimes hear things, where are those guys coming from?
I think Yossi and Danielle would agree with my assessment of them that they lean left. I don't think they've ever been, you know, pro-BB ever in their lives. But they are centrist left. They are not, in, you know, they're very Zionist left. They are people who wrestle with some of the more beautiful ideals and ideas of the left. You know, I personally would like to also be a universalist, not just a particularist, not just worried about my people, my tribe, but also about the world, about everybody's people, about Palestinians in Gaza. I have a lot of trouble and a lot of concern and a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear for Palestinians in Gaza. In that sense, is that left or is that, you know, I don't know what that is. But the point is they are, I think they would consider themselves center-left leaning people who don't like Bibi very much would be the short answer.
I just want to, then I listened to the commentary pod after you, and Ruthie Bloom calls in, that's John Chapod's sister, John Podhoretz's sister, editor-in-chief at Commentary, and she says 90% of Israel is 100% unified in finishing off Hamas. Is that a correct assessment?
Yes.
Whatever and however long the war requires, correct? Not whatever, because it is being a very careful, it's probably the most careful war I've ever seen waged, in fact. Even though the destruction is massive, it's because a lot of those buildings have been booby-trapped. And when you don't take down a building, you end up with 11 Israeli casualties, 3 to 4 of them KIA and the weather and others severely wounded. The trauma in Israel is so immense, proportionate. Do you think America gets it, the cost of this war in Israel? Not just the massacre, but the cost of the war and the fighting of the war.
You know, a double-digit percentage of families have, within their families, victims, soldiers, hostages. I know hostages. I have family, close family, my wife's two brothers, who were soldiers. I'm a very typical Israeli in having 3 or 4 points of intersection directly, personally, with the war. So this is a war that Israeli society is experiencing viscerally. You know, we Rachel Maddow, who I understand is not on your side of American politics, once wrote this actually a little bit fascinating book about the detachment between the American military deployments around the world and American civilian society. And she thought that because so many Americans don't experience the American military deployments, Americans have a bad discussion about them.
Oh, let me take a moment to agree with her. I have a son-in-law, and a nephew on active duty, and they've gone in harm's way, and the Iranians have tried to kill them. And so I understand what she's talking about, but boy, we don't get that.
Right.
So I just want to take a moment to say, yes, yeah. Rachel can occasionally be right. We got to come back on the air. We'll continue this on the other side. Stand by. Welcome back, America. Penultimate segment with Haviv Redegur on today's program and podcast. Haviv, I want to replay for you cut number 8, President Biden talking about Iran.
Creating stability in the Middle East also means containing the threat posed by Iran. That's why I built a coalition of more than a dozen countries to defend international shipping and freedom of navigation in the Red Sea. I've ordered strikes to degrade the Houthi capability and defend U.S. forces in the region. As Commander-in-Chief, I will not hesitate to direct further measures to protect our people and our military personnel.
Now, Habib, that's simply not true. He's directed 8 strikes. There have been more than 200 strikes on American personnel. He has not deterred the Houthis. The Red Sea is a menace. We are all suffering as a result of it, and we are not containing Iran. What did you make about that? I mean, he didn't really discuss what Iran is doing here or the northern border.
I was very disappointed. I don't want America's president to send Americans into harm's way, but here's the deal. Iran is on the move. It's on the march. It is a revolution. It believes itself to be a revolution. It is out to redeem Islam from centuries of weakness. It is out to cut a bloody path through the Middle East. It has already demolished 4 Arab Sunni countries. It is going to demolish more. It wants to destroy my country, but that's as a precursor to its vision of Islam returning as a power in history and then destroying other countries. You don't contain it. You challenge it. And if you think all you have to do is contain it, you're going to fail to challenge it. Iran is constantly testing. And if all you can do is push back and make them take a month delay and then test you again, They have won. They will continue to build out capabilities. They will challenge you more aggressively next time. I don't know how to say it more simply. You have to challenge Iran if you want the Middle East to be stable, if you want the revolutions and the destructions. You know, all of this Democratic Party anxiety and fear and upset, you know, over the suffering in Gaza. Well, the Syrian civil war was 20 times the death toll. It was an actual genocide, not a pretend genocide because of a war. It was an actual genocide with well over 500,000 dead, specifically by the Alawis targeting Sunnis, backed by Iran. These Alawis, which are an offshoot of Shia Islam, allies of the Iranians, targeting massively Sunni. I'll say more than that to your listeners. Syria in 2011 was 10% Christian. 80% of the Christians are gone after that civil war. Where's America? Where's the marches? Where's the pain? Where's the anxiety? Where's the fear? Where's the anger? Where's any of it? Absolutely any of it. That ultimately, at the end, is Iran. Nothing America can do for Lebanon. And America is constantly trying to spend money in Lebanon, to help Lebanon, to put Lebanon back on track. Lebanon is now a failed state. And nothing America does matters because Hezbollah, an arm of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, is demolishing Lebanon from within. You can't conduct a few airstrikes against the Houthis. 85,000 children starved to death in the Houthi war just, what, 6 years ago? You think an airstrike is going to matter to them? You either challenge Iran or you let the Middle East collapse in a miasma of pain, death, and suffering. And my problem with Iran, my enemies, my wars that I have to fight against all these Iranian proxies is just the tip of the iceberg. So I come to criticize President Biden while he continues missile shipments I need during a war. But I just have to tell you, if you don't challenge Iran powerfully, it won't matter whether you looked occasionally like you slightly contained it.
And we have literally 8 minutes left, so we're not going to solve this. Zarqawi, when he was alive, waged a terror campaign against Shias for the purpose, the express purpose of getting the big game going, the Iran-Sunni conflict. Is that just on hold if they agreed to destroy Israel and the United States first before they come to blows?
There is an intersection point between the radical Sunni vision of jihad and the radical Shia vision of jihad, the revolutionaries of Iran. And that intersection point is Israel / America / fighting the West for the moment right now. So, yes, Hamas is unique in that sense that it is a radical Sunni organization. But exactly as you say, it's embedded in the array of Shia proxies. And so, yes, this is a strange moment. By the way, as soon as the Jews are all dead, they're immediately going at each other's throats to massacre each other. But until the Jews are dead, they're working together. That's how they think of it. It's kind of how they talk about it, not on Al Jazeera interviews, but it's how they talk about it in their mosques. Let's put it that way.
Stand by. I have one more segment with Haviv, which will be available on the Highly Concentrated Hue podcast today and sometime next week on the radio show. I want to remind everyone, Haviv Rediger is available to follow on X at Haviv Rediger. His new podcast, What Matters Now, with Amanda Dan of the Times of Israel, has been up for 3 or 4 weeks now. It's fascinating. It's as good as anything else you'll get out of Israel. Someone remarked on Twitter last night that Haviv and broadcasts in the Times of Israel has become as important to America understanding the war in Gaza and the war against Israel as this is London was to Americans prior to Pearl Harbor. And so I would recommend both of them to you on an ongoing basis. I'll come back with one last chat with Haviv about Zionism and whether or not Americans understand it at all. After this, thank you for the first hour. I'll be back with Ben Domenech talking about domestic political reaction to what was the mumble shout, worst speech of the State of the Union that I've ever heard. But stay tuned. I am back now with my final 5 minutes with Haviv Rediger after the State of the Union. Haviv, John Podhoretz, Abe Greenwald over at Commentary have been carrying on a long conversation about whether Biden will ultimately screw Israel. And John says, no, facts are facts, and he sends the missiles. And Abe says, no, he's going to screw Israel. I'm with Abe. He's going to screw Israel because of domestic political considerations, because that's what Joe Biden is. He's a Paul. He's an old Irish Catholic Paul. And if I know anything, I know Irish Catholic Pauls. And when it comes down to it, where are the votes that he needs in November? What do you think is going to happen here? And what do you think of Trump? And he's not really said much on this.
First of all, Hugh, you know, I'm the least qualified of the people on this current conversation to answer that question. But I have been reliably informed by knowledgeable people, by people who are my teachers on all things American politics, that President Biden stands to lose more voters siding with the progressive politics of Michigan, let's say, of the Arab community in Michigan that's making certain demands of him, than he stands to gain. And he knows that. And so, you know, Michigan went to Trump by a historically narrow margin, 10,000 votes, 15,000 votes, something like that, back in 2016. Those were working class voters, not progressive voters, tilting over to the other side. And so the Democrats need to hold the working class. And therefore, that is not the same as holding the elite progressives or holding certain minority groups in the state of Michigan. And so I think President Biden understands that he's going to win or lose Michigan based on the economy. He's going to win or lose Michigan based on appearing to take a centrist road. I don't think he thinks that progressive campaigning for progressive politics is a way to win. So I suspect that if I don't just think that that's true, which I do think that's true strategically, but I also think he knows that and he's acted that way. So I don't think he's going to throw us under the bus for Michigan. Having said that, if I were him and I had this other country that, you know, we had whatever issues and whatever debates we had about it, I would throw them under the bus to win the presidency. I don't expect him to do otherwise. I wouldn't expect Trump, by the way, to stick with us and lose the presidency over it. Obviously, an American president's first responsibility, an American campaigner's first responsibility is to win an American election. So if he does throw us under the bus, I want to make this very clear. I will say thank you for everything you've done for us. Of course you threw us under the bus for Michigan. Why wouldn't you, right? So I'm comfortable either way with that. But I do think if he does, that's a political mistake. But, you know, he has much smarter political people than me, you know.
No, he doesn't, so, Habib. I want to assure you he doesn't. He's got really bad political advisors. And if that's not me, that's David Axelrod, who is maybe the best on the Democratic side. Let me conclude. I think there's a reconfiguration of the Democratic and Republican Party around Israel happening that will be significant. We'll find out if I'm right in November. Is there a reconfiguration in Israeli politics? And do the failures that led up to 10-7 blindness fundamentally reshuffle the deck whenever the deck is reshuffled after the war is done, or at least a temporary peace resumes?
The simple answer is yes. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu hasn't really won an election poll. I don't think he's won a single one. I read every single one. I don't think he's won a single one since January 2023. That's an awfully long time to not win a single poll. And since October 7, he's been losing them by 20 points. It's a little bit complicated how you build coalitions and how you build elections.
No, that I get, but I mean, who emerges? Yeah, everyone's complicit, right? Benny Gantz was there. Naftali was there. Yair Lapid had the reins of power for the IDF, Mossad, Shin Bet. Everyone failed. Does it reshuffle to a younger generation that says, like a lot of the people in America, we got to move on from the 70-year-olds and the 60-year-olds and get to a new generation of leadership? Is that happening?
That will happen. It won't happen in the next election cycle. But by the way, the soldiers in Gaza, we're seeing among the soldiers in Gaza, left wingers, right wingers fighting together, shoulder to shoulder, coming out with a new conversation about politics, a new demand. You know, we basically lost a lot of our good people from politics as they went over into more productive places. They built the high-tech economy, which is 10% of our salaried workforce. They built all of our massive and incredible strengths. Well, those good people are now coming back and saying, we can't afford the kind of rundown, bad, grimy politics we've had because they actually hurt us terribly and maybe also contributed to our enemies thinking we're weak and therefore to October 7th. But in the shorter term, I have to tell you, the Israeli public does not distinguish between who was responsible for October 7 and who wasn't. The most trusted politician in Israel right now, as far as we can tell from the polls, is Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, who was the defense minister on October 7th. And the least trusted person in power right now, according to every poll that we asked this question, is Benjamin Netanyahu. And the difference isn't whether they were specifically in power at the time. The difference is, did they take responsibility, and are they seen by the public as, instead of campaigning, actually worrying and thinking carefully about the war? Gallant is believed by right-wingers, not just the left, also the left. He's a right-wing Likud man, but the left trusts him to fight the war. Netanyahu has lost, every poll we have says this, has lost something like 30-40% of the right when we ask, do you trust Netanyahu not to be politicking but to be fighting the war? And so I do think there's going to be a reshuffle immediately in the next election. The polls right now say Gantz, a lot can happen. In other words, that doesn't mean Gantz is next. But over the longer term, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years out, that new generation is being made right now in Gaza.
That's an interesting place to end. Haviv Rediger, I appreciate spending an hour with me. It's a perspective on the State of the Union that I don't think anyone else will get from anywhere else. And I appreciate as well your gracious comments about the president in the United States at the beginning, at the top, because I think that is an important thing to note. And I hope it endures. I'll talk to you again soon. Thank you for coming back. I really thank you for taking a full hour with me today, Haviv.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
Sure tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is. But we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that, because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is and it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's
864-644-1900.
Morning Glory America, bonjour, hi Canada, Hugh Hewitt live from the ReliefFactor.com studio on the West Coast. I've just spent a full hour talking with Haviv Rediger in Israel about an Israeli, very, very brilliant man's assessment of the State of the Union address, and that will be up at my podcast later. Now I'm joined by Ben Domenech, editor-at-large for The Spectator, Fox News contributor, who is, like me, I think, astonished and appalled. Ben, good morning. Thank you for joining me.
Hugh, I appreciate the opportunity to join you. I will try to restrain my reaction here a bit, only because I think I could get a little too hot. I am so disturbed and disappointed by what we saw last night. This is the, and I say this as, you know, in the context of having, you know, worked on, it was in the White House presidential speechwriting office, you know, under George W. Bush. I've worked on major speeches, you know, over the years, in the beginning of my career. I know what went into this, and the choice that they made with this speech and then the way that it was delivered is the most appalling thing that I have ever seen at the State of the Union. This is the choice to go out on this, to reset the Biden reelection campaign on this note is appalling. It is disastrous. I don't know what they were thinking, but this is the absolute worst version of this politician. Divisive, partisan, angry, irritable, and then race baiting, and also, you know, frankly, he's the worst one with the whole thing, attacking the Supreme Court, who had to survive through assassination attempts and protests in front of their homes against their families directly from the podium. I could not believe that. This is the absolute worst partisan president delivery of a State of the Union that I've seen in my life. I can't believe that they make this decision, but it clearly was a choice. It was something the White House chose to do.
Now, Ben, I'm going to have you unpack that for a moment. I want people to understand. I was very vocal on Twitter last night, very similar to Ben. And I've seen between 40 and 50 of these things. And while I wasn't a speechwriter, I was a White House lawyer, and Peter Robinson and the gang and Peggy worked down the hall. And I know what goes into a State of the Union. And I've been inspired by them. I have been impressed. W's in the aftermath of early 2002, the Axis of Evil speech, lifted and unified a country. I've been disappointed by past State of the Unions. I have never been disturbed. But Ben, at the end of it, I was watching with my wife. I said, did Bin Laden win? Because after 22 years, the country is in this state that could be the State of the Union. I mean, I trace it all back to the trauma of 9/11, decisions made by W that were supported by Democrats to go into Iraq, the politics of Florida in 2000. Did he win, Ben? Ever put this back together again?
I mean, the thing that, look, we've seen the version of Joe Biden that the Democrats sold, over the years as being this sunny, uplifting, a gentleman politician. And I think that that's something that absolutely was eradicated if it hadn't been eradicated by his policies, he eradicated it himself last night. This is going to be his legacy. And I think that it's going to be his legacy because I think he's going to lose. And I think that this is going to be the last major statement he really makes to the country. The truth is that this guy is so divisive now. He's so angry and bitter. He's like, do you see anything from this person who says that any Republican should work with him on any subject, any topic, that they can trust him at all? I mean, it's unfathomable for a guy whose reputation, and I will say that reputation was often unearned. Those of us who remember the way that he treated Clarence Thomas, those of us who remember some of the ways that he dealt underhandedly during his time as vice president, we know that a lot of that was stuff that was branding and not really true. But this is laid bare. And look, I spent a lot of time on Fox. I'm sure that your listeners are probably irritated with how often I've been on in the last 36 hours or so. But I've been on, regularly with Harold Ford, and Harold Ford going into last night was saying, well, I just hope that he's, going to send a message that's uplifting and optimistic and gives people something to hope for and look forward to after this election. It was the opposite. This was dark. It was despairing, and it was vindictive. And I feel like, I know that, when it comes to the preparation on these things, meaning this isn't like an off the cuff thing. This isn't something that just, Biden shouting at a reporter, Biden shouting at, some question, in answer to some question from Peter Ducey. This is prepared. This is, put into the script. They put it into the prompter. They chose to put 77 exclamation points in it. They chose to, give him whatever cocktail they gave him to boost him up for the night. And I just am flabbergasted that this is the way the White House chose to fight this battle. It's the opposite of what they should have done.
Are the Democrats online deceiving themselves or pretending that they think it was a good speech? Because I try to be objective about this. You cannot mumble, shout, and scream, and bait, and do things like mispronounce Bobby Kennedy or say Lincoln Riley when you're supposed to say Lake and Riley. You cannot engage in a straw man argument with James Lankford, who you just threw under the bus there, instead of making an appeal to resurrect the Lankford bill and bring me something. I will add more to it. There are ways it could have been done, but it's a reelection campaign. Do Democrats actually believe what they're writing? Because I believe what I'm writing. It was a disaster.
I actually don't think they believe it. I think that there are a lot of smart Democrats out there who understand that this was not the tone to sound. However, I do think that the White House's decision on this is kind of a vindication of everyone who's been saying all along that the Democrats behind the scenes who have Biden's ear and who are actually running things, they're of the opinion that their biggest problem are those progressives in the street who are laying down, on the route between the White House and the Capitol building, protesting about Gaza, that their big problem is just, we need to get back those, 100,000 votes in Michigan. We need to get back those uncommitted votes in Minnesota, et cetera. And if we just get those people back on our side, then we'll be fine. And that is, a continuation, including this betrayal, from my perspective, on the Israel front of dealing with Gaza the way that they've chosen to. It is something where they feel like that's really their problem. And as long as they get those people back in the fold, they'll be fine. I think that that's a huge mistake. I think that those people are not the future. I think that they are the fringe. I think that they are, it's catering to people who are going to end up voting for somebody like Cornel West or Jill Stein. And I think it's absolutely idiotic, but it's what the White House apparently thinks. And they also apparently think that they don't need to sound any kind of conciliatory tone. They don't need to have some kind of fiction about bringing the country back together, because none of that was really in here. Instead, I think that they just want to activate their base and turn it into a referendum on Donald Trump, who hasn't been president for 4 years. So it's one of these situations where they think that they can just flip this. And I am just astounded. This would be This would be irritating and appalling, even if it was just a campaign speech, but it was given as a State of the Union. That is unacceptable. It is embarrassing, and I can't believe that they made this choice.
Last question, Ben. Do you think some of his old colleagues in the Senate feel sorry for him? Because I really, at some points, I felt sympathy for him.
You know what? That is actually, Hugh, that's a great question, and I know for a fact that they do. I have had multiple conversations with, as it just happens, Democrat senators over the past couple of weeks about, you know, various issues. I just happened to have the opportunity. And all of them say, behind the scenes, they say, you know, it's hard to talk to him. It's hard to communicate with him. You know, we're not, you know, we know that he's not going to be able to make it four more years. That's something that is just an open secret within, you know, their conversations. I don't know. I mean, we both know why, you know, Politico and Axios and places like that don't report that. But it's something that you will get very, very quickly out of a Democratic senator if you have a good relationship with
him. I actually felt sorry for him last night. And I will find out from my I don't talk to Democratic senators often, but I'll find out from Republican senators. B. Dominich on X. Thank you, Ben. I thought your commentary last night in real time was great. And I appreciate your joining me this morning.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.